to Founder Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bearmetrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with myself. So I walk through the past 15 years of business and 50 plus projects and businesses over those 15 years. We walk through the whole thing. It's a big one. So this was actually originally live streamed for a couple hundred people. And so there's some bits here where I'm like, you know, I'm on video. So, but the audio translates just as fine. So I hope you enjoy this episode and all of the ups and downs of the things that I've done over the past 15 years that led to what I'm doing now. So that's all. Let's, before we jump in, if you enjoy the interviews that we do with founders in general, or if you enjoy this episode, whatever, a rating on iTunes, sharing the episode on social networks, etc. That stuff goes a really long way. At any rate, on with the show. All right, let's jump into this episode of Founder Chats. So this episode's going to be a little bit different in that I'm not interviewing another founder except myself. So I'm sort of interviewing myself here, but I'm not going to ask myself questions here. It's a little too introspective. But I do want to give kind of my history, kind of how I got into making stuff, then go through this spreadsheet that I've put together of way too many projects over the past 15 years and try to tie it all together and show how one thing led to another, which led to another, et cetera, and how all these things kind of play together. So I guess like starting at the beginning, which is how a lot of these, you know, episodes of Founder Chat start, is like, what were you like as a kid, or what were you into as a kid? And for me, I was that token entrepreneurial kid who was like always looking to, you know, I'd make the poster and stick it on a stick out in the front yard saying like, hey, will you buy, I don't even remember like the kind of stuff I would sell. I mean, cakes, like random things that I would make, Legos, whatever it was, like, hey, stop by the house and buy some stuff. And then as I got older, we're, you know, old enough to push a lawnmower, unquestionably cut some yards. And now it's still the same thing. You know, I'd put a sign up in the front yard, like, hey, I'll cut your yard. So I did lots of mowing lawns. But while I was also this entrepreneurial kid, I was also a very much like the kid that was making stuff all the time too. I remember like model airplanes, like assembling those things or just inventing stuff or like digging holes and making forts in the ground, like just weird stuff, but also very typical kid stuff. And so I think like those two things of wanting to make stuff and also wanting to not sell stuff. I don't consider myself a salesperson at all, but entrepreneurial in that like I wanted other people to potentially like to be interested in the things that I was making as well. And so that has a constant thread throughout my entire life. I think once you get into the sort of the 90s is when computers start playing a role here. So, you know, I remember my dad when I was, I don't know, I guess I was probably 5 or 6. So this actually been late 80s. Got our first computer. I don't even know what kind it was, but it was one of these like single color, you know, whatever, like orange color on the screen, all text, whatever. And you know, just being fascinated by it. And those things we upgraded like quickly, always had some new computer, but it was always like the cheapest thing my dad could find. But we were, you know, to my dad's credit, like even though he is very much always looks for the cheapest thing, the cheapest version of anything on the planet, he always was trying out new computers, probably because they kept breaking, because he kept getting like the cheapest thing he could find. But that quickly turned into when AOL came on the scene. So that was huge. The internet, you know, blew my mind because you could, like, I quickly got into, for me at that time, AOL was the internet. You know, it's like you get the little discs with, you know, 10 free hours of internet, which was more than enough at that point in time, right? And we just kept using those. And I kept just, you know, I'd be on AOL and I'd go to all these different chat rooms and like, I don't know, you search for just obscure stuff and it was there, right? Like you could find anything. It was super interesting. And AOL became just like a cornerstone of my childhood on some level. And like that turned into once we got out of just AOL, you got into some regular internet. I don't even remember who like the internet provider was even necessarily, but you get into things like GeoCities and Tripod, like these free website hosting places, which made it really easy to just throw something up on the internet. And that became, you know, like the thing that I wanted to do was like make websites. So I'd make websites for bands I was in. I'd make websites about bands that I liked. You know, you'd like upload WAVE files of like audio ripped from a CD, which was insane then. And I, that kind of got me addicted to making websites. But I mean, at that point in time, it's still just all HTML. This is even like pre, you know, CSS stuff. This is all just hard-coded, nasty HTML. And, you know, background colors on tables and like everything's laid out with tables and all this stuff, just crazy stuff. So I was really big into that. And I think making websites for the bands I was in ultimately translated to when I went to college, I started making websites again for bands I was in, but also for other bands. They were asking me, like I was the guy who knew how to make websites. This was like 2001 ish. And, so that started leading into, okay, now I've got people like asking for other things that aren't just my ideas here. So it like pushed me to learn even, and, you know, newer things, newer technologies or newer ways to do things. And so I just was making websites left and right constantly. And then I got to the point where I wanted to learn how to actually program stuff. So up to then I was like, I would download random like scripts you would find. There's a site called Hot Scripts. I think it had like a little chili pepper as the, in the logo, if I remember correctly. And you know, you download like a forum software or poll software or whatever. And you just like download these things, upload them to some random server. And I had no idea what I was doing, but you can kind of hack your way to use being able to like put something together. And so I had done all that, but I wanted to learn how to make something from scratch for myself. And so that is really sort of what kicked off, really like that spreadsheet. So if you haven't seen the spreadsheet, I don't know, a week and a half ago, I put together the spreadsheet of 57 different projects and businesses that I've created or worked on or built in the past 15 years. And so since about 2003. And what we're going to do now is like walk through those. So the very first thing that like I've built from scratch was this site called reallydumbstuff.com. So one of the easiest things to build from a programming standpoint, this was like me teaching myself PHP. So one of the easiest things to build is essentially just like a link directory. Those were also really big, like popular things back in the early 2000s. Because, you know, it's like search, like Google search wasn't as sort of the like starting point for a lot of things as it is now. And so people curating, you know, random things and putting them into a list of links, was a really big deal then. Now, I guess that's like the equivalent of like, you know, blog posts with like 15 ways to do whatever. It's like that was back then, that was what this was basically. So I liked dumb stuff. I still do. And I decided like, hey, I find dumb stuff on the internet all the time. Let me put these into a link thing and I'll figure out how to build, you know, this website with PHP and all this stuff. So that's what first thing I did was reallydumbstuff.com. And at the same time that I was teaching myself programming, I'd also started seeing like people making money off ad revenue. So making money from like putting a banner ad, or multiple banner ads, lots of different ways that you can put ads on a page. And it's like, hey, this is a great idea. I can make some money. I'm a college kid, right? And I want to be able to, you know, make some money, but also learn some programming at the same time. Let's combine those two. So really dumb stuff is how that sort of kicked things off, me making money on the internet. And then shortly thereafter, at the same time, online flash games were a really big deal. So, you know, miniclip.com was a really big one. And it was just, you just go there and just play random games online, but they're all made out of flash. But the big benefit of that is that flash can be very self-contained. So they could give you an embed code and you could copy and paste that, put it on your website, and somebody could play the game on your own site. So so that's prompted the sister site to Really Dumb Stuff, which was reallyfunarcade.com. And that was, again, it was like this link directory of flash games and other places, but also like embedded flash games that you could play on the website. And so, you know, same thing though, made money from advertising. And like, you can make a ton of money from advertising. And I'll get into this in a couple of, but like a lot of money from just stupid websites like this. So Really Dumb Stuff beget Really Fun Arcade. And then about a year after that, I actually ended up selling it for like $4,500, something around there, like $4,000, $5,000. I don't even remember how I sold, how I found the buyer for that one. But either way, as a college kid, I just, all of a sudden, somebody gave me thousands of dollars for this thing. Like, it blew my mind. So either way, that's Really Marquee. Then the next thing I decided, so I was big into music. And I wanted to make this community website with like music reviews and people could post their music or art or videos. This is like before there's even like video uploading, really. Like, it wasn't even that easy to do then. And so that thing was called Indie Riot. And I decided I was going to launch it in phases. So like do the music phase first and then art and then film. I got the music part launched. And I even had, you know, a few bands send me albums to like listen to and review and post reviews of. There were forums. We talk about like shows. I interviewed some bands. Like, I was trying to get this like online publication off the ground. And Ultima just sort of like, it was too much work and I couldn't get enough traction to it. Just didn't, you know, this is pre-social media. Like, it's hard to find people. It's, you know, it has to be very sort of organic word of mouth. So that I ended up shutting that down. At the same time, I started doing, you know, I mentioned I had all these bands like asking me to do stuff. Well, like at that point, it's like, well, you should start some sort of consulting thing, right? Like, you should have this official thing to make stuff under. So the first thing I did was, and I was in school at the time for graphic design. So I started this thing called Automatic Studios, Automatic with a K, because 2003, and that was, I did lots of work under that, consulting stuff. At the same time, this is still all 2003, the next thing I launched was called Tutorial Outpost. So back to the link directory thing, because I'm a design student, I'm looking for ways to do stuff in Photoshop, right? So how do you make a fireball in Photoshop? Or how do you make a planet or whatever? You know, like, how do you lay out a magazine? Which, don't lay out a magazine in Photoshop. It's a bad idea. So I have searching the internet for all this stuff and decided, like, hey, we should do this. Like, let me make a link directory of the things that I like. And that took on a lot of different forms over the next few years where, you know, I like ended up adding some forums. So like forums were a big deal back then. And so the forums were pretty active. Then started writing my own original tutorials to be posted on the website. That worked well. Started like partnering with Adobe to do giveaways. So like they would give us or give me, you know, all these different, you could buy Photoshop or Creative Suite in a box. Like you could, it wasn't a web-based thing at all, or you couldn't download it. You'd buy this massive box of all the software. So like they would sponsor these giveaways to that we would do on Tutorial Outpost. So that turned into like a pretty big thing where that was, so that was from about 2003 to maybe 2000, I guess, 2008 or something like that, 2009. I can't remember exactly, but that was the site where the ad revenue was absurd. Like, as a college kid, I was making $2,000-$3,000 a month off of ad revenue on this link directory of Photoshop tutorials, which is crazy. And so that was like, whoa, okay, I didn't need that was my job in college, was websites and ad revenue, right? So ended up selling that thing 5-6 years later for almost $20,000. But by the time it sold, like, the whole like ad revenue world was kind of crashing. This was, I think, around, you know, the recession, which happened around 2007, 2008. I mean, like, you just couldn't make a lot of money off ad revenue. And so ended up selling it. And I mean, still, you know, almost $20,000, not too bad. Especially, guessing ballpark here, like $20,000 to $30,000 off ad revenue over the years. Crazy. But that was sort of, after that, I hit a string of some of my worst ideas. So after 2003, I got into, sounds like I'm about to say something like drugs or like meth. I'm not. This is the nerdiest thing to like get into in a dark way. I had been reading, you know, you read about the way that you read about startups now and SaaS companies, and like so-and-so may, you know, like rocket ship growth and like, or hockey stick growth. And like, you start reading about all the different ways that people are having success making money. And back then, it wasn't SaaS companies or startups. It was people like, you know, it was like affiliate stuff or pay-per-click arbitrage, like just these weird ways that people, one or two people, had all of a sudden made tons of money. And one of those was via Amazon affiliate stuff. So the way that it worked, I mentioned the arbitrage stuff, is you could pay on like Google AdWords. You could say like, or whatever, you know, it was back then that a lot of people were using. You could say like, okay, I'll pay 5 cents a click to send people here, but then I'll make 10 cents a click off of an Amazon affiliate sale. And then you just scale that up and then you make millions, right? So so what I started doing was making a bunch of Amazon affiliate sites. So, I mean, I think I've got almost a dozen of them here. And just weird things. So like The Fun Mall, Lawn and Garden Outlet, Brush Source, Smart Pet Shop, E-Kitchen Shop, Jewelry Shopper Online, MagazineReviews.net, Arcade Rampage, Apple Leak, Poster Outpost, All Tropical Vacations, Harmony Period. All of these, just the worst, like, in hindsight, terrible, terrible ideas that were obviously a big distraction, and me just, like, getting, you know, distracted by the idea or getting obsessed with the idea of, like, hey, that guy, he made some Amazon affiliate sites, and he makes hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so, you know, you buy all these domains, you put these like Amazon affiliate scripts that like pull the Amazon stuff on the website, and then people click through, whatever. Like, I spent way more money on just domains than I ever even kind of made on the affiliate stuff. I mean, I probably made 50 cents on the affiliate stuff across all of those sites. So, like, total, definitely a loss completely. But at the same time, towards that, this is all 2004, really. Towards the end of 2004, I got into, I was getting really big into video editing. So, and a lot of that stuff happens, especially like nonlinear video editing, is most popular on like a Mac. And so I was using Macs a lot, and in the graphic design world too, which was, you know, that was my major in college. So like, I'm using Macs all day. But at the time, I was not, you know, I had a PC, I'd built my own computer, all that stuff. I was using Windows. So I decide to switch from Windows, from Microsoft to Mac, PC to Mac, and I decided to make a website about it. Right, like, of course, that's what normal people do. So I made a blog, and blogs were becoming a thing too. So like, blogging as legit publications was really starting to pick up then. This was, yeah, 2004. So I made the appleblog.com. Now, I'm certainly at the time did not consider myself a writer. I didn't enjoy reviewing products or even writing about Apple necessarily. So what I did was find writers, and I wasn't paying them, except they were getting like free like Apple stuff, you know? So it's like Logitech would have some new mouse and they'd send you a mouse to review. And like, that was what you essentially was like your payment for it. So it's like these people were writing for free initially and getting like free random gear because of it. So like that's how that started. And like most of the posts written there were not written by me. They were written by writers, you know, on a staff of writers I had. And I was making money from ad revenue. And again, like you could still make good money from ad revenue. And I was making thousands of dollars a month. And at that point in time, I was actually ended up using a lot of the thousands of dollars a month to pay writers. I mean, ultimately like it morphed into, okay, I can pay you now. And so it turned into this solid business that 4 years later, it's 2008. There was, I guess it's still around, but not in its form then. So there was a major tech publication called GigaOm that existed in 2008 that ultimately decided to acquire it. So they paid, I think, around $75,000 for it. Plus, I was an employee there for 2 years, basically running the Apple blog sort of as its own individual entity. That was probably the biggest, that was a huge deal for me. At that point, by the time I sold, I was married, had a house, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that became like that sort of all the stupid stuff I'd done before. I didn't do as many stupid things, like at least in the, ooh, let me see if I can get rich quick thing. By the time I sold it. So let's jump back to 2004, because this is before the Apple blog starts taking off. I decide to keep trying some stupid stuff. So if we keep moving down the list here, so Automatic Studios, which is like the shell company, ultimately transitioned into Sabotage Media, which is actually still like, Sabotage Media LLC is my sort of shell company that I do most everything except for Baremetrics. It all exists under this sort of Sabotage Media legal entity. That's all the taxes go through that stuff. And I started that back in 2004. And I was doing, at the time, lots of consulting stuff was happening under there. That started in 2004. Then I started a few more of these just terrible idea things. So I had like Medicine DB, which is like, we had transitioned away from Amazon affiliate stuff to let's just have content sites that we put advertising on. So this was one of those, it was like directory of medicine. Like what? I have no idea what I was thinking, but you know, you download lots of stuff about medicine, like a WebMD kind of thing. And then the next, this is one of my favorites, Survive the War. Like, oh man, I'm not a prepper, but man, that site was for Survive the War. God, good grief. So, same thing. You just put like information about prepping and like surviving a war, the apocalypse or something. Gah! And then to go along with that, first aid support. So how to do first aid. I hope you never visited that site to learn how to do first aid, man. Okay. That was the end of like the weird content affiliate stuff. And then I started making sort of these like mini web apps. I think I was still putting advertising on there. So it was like codepaste.net, which is like, you know, you need to share code with somebody. You just paste the code in there and then you'd have a URL that you could go share with. Then there was the file bin and my mega file. So sort of like a Dropbox kind of thing, at least as far as like a file, easy way to upload a file and then you can share it with somebody. We're talking like the thing I was doing was like giving away 50 megabytes for free or 100 megabytes. Like that's the kind of stuff that existed then. Like people weren't sharing multi-gigabyte files. It'd be like sharing some video or something like that. You just need to share like a way to send it to someone. So you'd set up hosting and then have this place to dump. This is even pre-Amazon AWS. Like Yeah. Either way, needless to say, I did not make any money off those. Lost money. Then there, man, what a name. This next thing called Doinko, which I don't think I ever had to say it out loud. Otherwise, I would have changed that name real quick. So music video embedding was what that did. So you'd find all these bands were starting to post more videos online, but still like YouTube or Vimeo like weren't these really popular things. I don't even remember what year YouTube even started. Either way, embedding videos was not an easy thing to do. So you could put a video on there and then like we would give you a way to embed that and share it on like your band's website or whatever. So the idea at the time I thought was great, but the execution just didn't happen. Then there's this community site called 26 Faves. So the idea here was you would basically fill out sort of a survey or profile of your favorite things for each letter of the alphabet. So for A, your favorite thing might be aardvarks, and B might be beer. I don't know, whatever. So like you would come up with your 26 favorite things based on the letters of the alphabet, and then you could discuss them. That never took off. Community stuff's really hard to build. You know, still is to this day. Then there was Brush Find. So this is still 2005. Brush Find, where you still sort of like a link directory, but Photoshop brushes were a big deal. So, you know, especially like grunge design was also big then, or had been. And, you know, you were always looking for like cool Photoshop brushes to like make your designs look super emo. So it was a link directory as well, made it, and then a year later sold it for like $700. Then the next thing I built was a thing called Stat Blocks. So this was like hit counters were kind of a thing. So, you know, you'd see like 500 people, a little counter at the bottom of the website. And this was like basic sort of web stats, which I guess, you know, this is sort of like a, like I'm doing stats stuff now with Baremetrics, but either way, that didn't ever take off. That was hard to like get some traction there. Then the next thing, early 2006, that I built was this thing called Adrigate. So obviously I've ad revenue has had at that point, you know, for the past 3-4 years have been playing a major role in my business. And you had lots of different, these ad networks, which I'm trying to think, there's like Tribal Fusion, something that begins with a V, I think. I mean, obviously Google, AdSense was a big one. Value Click, like all these things where you would sign up and then they would give you a code to just drop on your website and then they would handle all the ad stuff. Now, I started realizing I could sell my own ads and make more money and control who was advertising on the site. I didn't have to have all these like stupid, like fast blinking, you know, seizure inducing click here banners that were showing all over the place. So I built this ad management platform, actually initially with a guy named Kyle Neath, who ended up being like the first designer at GitHub. But he and I were buddies back then. And so we initially built this thing and he ended up moving on before it even launched. But then like it was so close to being ready, like it was functioning, but I hadn't officially like announced it or launched it yet. And the week that I was going to launch it, Google announces their own ad management platform. I forget what it was called, but I mean, it was essentially exactly what we were doing, but on this massive scale. And at the time, it was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't compete with Google. Like, it was that sort of feeling. Like, I had not ever had to deal with competition. And at the time, it scared me a lot. And simultaneously, I had had what turned out to be a terrible experience with a CPA. So I was living in Denver at the time, filing taxes had been sort of new to me. And so I just found a CPA. And then turns out he just didn't have any experience with web-based anything. I think he was just a terrible CPA to begin with, apparently. Either way, he had improperly filed taxes for the prior couple of years, which ultimately led to me having like a, I don't know, I think it was like a $10,000 tax bill, somewhere around there, like $10,000-$12,000 tax bill. And just like, what in the world am I going to do? Like, come up with 10,000 bucks. So I decided like that, the timing of that, plus Google launching this thing that in my head was going to crush my ad management platform, decided, let me just sell this software off and see what I can get for it. So I listed it for sale, and I actually got $10,000 for it, which was great. Like, you know, somebody, I don't think it, they did not even do anything with it, but ultimately I got $10,000 for what amounts to what would have been like a consulting project, right? Like it was like somebody paid me to build this app for them. I think that's one of those things, like it's the first sort of like, man, I wish I had not sold that. Because I think in hindsight, it would have been an interesting thing. Now there's like the equivalent would be like, now it's like buysellads.com. So like Todd Garland, who runs that thing, like fantastic platform, great company. And you know, obviously like it's an idea that had legs and I just chickened out. So probably like first like major regret in the business world. So either way, so that was 2006. Also in 2006, So I launched this thing called Fugitive Toys. So in college, I started collecting these things called Urban Vinyl Toys, which, hold on just a second. I've actually got one I can show you. So like, you can't see this on the podcast, but video. So you got things like this guy. So this is a like a dunny. So I've got over here this whole shelf full of like weird toys like this. Like these sort of like art toys. Like a lot of times like graffiti artists are big into these. I'm not a graffiti artist, but like they design a lot of these stuff and they just look cool. So I was big into collecting those in college. And then after I got out of college, I was like, hey, an e-commerce site could be a fun deal. And so I decided to start an e-commerce company. Now, this is the first thing where I decided to start it with a few other people. So like part of this was I wanted for us to have actual stock. Like, we have the toys, we ship them out. And at the time, you know, that costs money to buy a bunch of stock. And so I decided, you know, I started chatting with some other people. And ultimately, like, me and I had two other co-founders, one of which was Mubs, which a lot of people know from Product Hunt, just because he's, like, the top maker there. So this was, you know, 12 years ago. I have no idea how I even met him. But ultimately, me, him, and then another guy who used to be a writer on the Apple blog, so that's how I knew that guy, decided to start this toy company. And, you know, I'm in my apartment with my, you know, it's me and my wife in an apartment. Mubs is, I think, in New York. He's going to take care of all the coding stuff. And then Nick was the other third co-founder. He lived in Denver with me, not with me. He lived also in Denver. But he had a house with a room that could store all the toys. And he was going to be responsible for shipping. And so we all put money in and, you know, bought up a ton of toys to, you know, wholesale. And then we'd resell them. And that thing, man, that was a ton of fun. Like, super fun. A couple years after that, like after 2006, we ended up, my wife and I bought out the two co-founders and we're just 100% running it ourselves. And that thing was a ton of fun. That led into late 2007, 2008 was when recession stuff hit. And turns out when people don't have as much money, they don't buy collectible toys. So, you know, it was like, I remember in 2007, we like that Christmas, I think we made like $15,000 or $20,000 in that month. Like it was a good month. And then a year later, this is after all the recession stuff, we made like $5,000. Like people just weren't spending money on toys and because they didn't have as much disposable income. And I was like, okay, now's not that we can't keep this up. We also at that point were pregnant with our first kid and my wife had been the one like handling packing all the stuff and like carrying these boxes up and down our basement, up and down from our basement to ship stuff out. And like, you know, she didn't want to be like 9 months pregnant and trying to like lug boxes up and down the stairs and all this stuff. And then the business side just like was not panning out. So we ended up selling that off. A few years later, sold it for $26,000, which, you know, like that was fine for what it was making at the time, like because of after the economy kind of hit the fan. So that's Fugitive Toys. That gave me like my first taste of e-commerce that I loved. Man, love e-commerce stuff, which is like, which I'll get into this later, but like I eventually come back around to e-commerce stuff. Okay, we gotta keep moving along here because we still have a number of things to cover. So next up in that same time frame, 2006, I start building little more like kind of what you would say are like traditional apps or like these more interactive things. So there was a Ban That, which was this community based around things that people didn't like. Like, I don't, that seems like a really toxic idea. And it was, right? Like the entire premise of the thing is like, let's complain about all the things that we hate. I don't, whatever. So sold that though a year later for $2,000. Next was this thing called Arcaplay, back to the online gaming thing. So same sort of deal as really fun arcade, but more, less links out to other sites and more games right on the site. And then there was this whole community thing around it where you could, you know, rate games from 0 to 5 stars. There was like commenting and all this stuff. So sold that for $2,700 a year later. Then I made this series of little sort of mini apps. So there was My Poll Creator, Mad Lib Creator, My Quiz Creator. So these three different like tools where you could create a poll, Mad Libs or quizzes, and then embed them on your website or send people this link to take a quiz or do a Mad Lib or something like that. Those never went anywhere. I don't remember why though. Like, I mean, one, I just think that there was probably lots of those things that existed then. But I just shut them down. I don't know why. In hindsight, I don't know why I did that, but you know, that was a long time ago. Then 2006, was a thing called FlexSpot. So at the time, hosting was becoming more accessible, like getting web hosting. And then that also meant that it was accessible for reselling. So you basically, like I was a, you know, was like white labeling or using like white labeled hosting software to set up servers for people. So I shut that down because I had like one customer. Right. So also 2006 started this thing called Track the Pack. So Track the Pack was initially started out as like a scratch my own itch thing for Fugitive Toys. So with Fugitive Toys, toys, a lot of them, the majority of them are made like in China. So lots of, at any given time, there were dozens of packages on their way to me from China. And, you know, those things would take weeks to get to you. So I needed a place to track all these packages in one place. You know, you get a tracking number and figure out when they were gonna get there and make sure I just didn't, like, forget, like, oh, that package was supposed to come in with, you know, $3,000 worth of toys. So I built Track the Pack as a way to, you know, just a central place to do package tracking. And that started as this, like, consumer thing where obviously anybody could just post, you know, their tracking numbers. You could email in your track, like forward a tracking email, and it would find the tracking number in there and automatically add it to your account. It was pretty cool. And then my first sort of like SaaS product came out of this, which was e-commerce is obviously like becoming a bigger thing. Other people need to offer package tracking because what was happening was they would send an email saying, hey, your package is shipped. And then it would include a link to the tracking number, but it would send you to like the UPS website. So, or the FedEx website. And it's like, you can embed that stuff directly in your store. And that's another opportunity to like sell them another product or whatever. So I made a commercial version. It was called Track the Pack Commercial. And from there you could, you know, a e-commerce site could embed package tracking. And I felt like it was a pretty good idea, especially at the time, given the technology that was available, like there wasn't really another, that was your only option really, or build your own thing internally. So had a number of pretty big websites, e-commerce sites using it. It was making, I don't know, maybe at its height, like $400 or $500 a month or something like that. It wasn't great. But ultimately like 6 years, so 6 years later, I ended up selling it. So I think I was, what was I doing at the time? Oh, I started in the future. You'll hear about this. Pop Survey is another thing I was working on. So I decided, like, I needed to focus in on what I was doing 6 years later and decided to sell off Track the Pack. And so I sell it, like, sale completes, guy pays me $11,000. And at the last second, I, like, something hit me. I was just like, no, I can make this a thing. Like, I can double down on this. And, like, it's, this thing is a, still a good idea, and I'm going to stick with it. Ended up, like, sending the guy his money back. He was ticked for good reason. Yeah. And like, the worst of it is I still ended up, like, a year later, like, shut it down. I lost $11,000 off that thing, man. A second sort of business regret. Okay, so also still in 2006, I started this thing called Designer Side, which was like this like community for graphic design assets. I think of it like a like Creative Market is today, or like you think of like Envato has all those different, like the whole network of different like graphic asset downloading things. Either way, same sort of idea. 2006, I produce all of the assets. Like, this was all original stuff that was going to be sold. Ended up not making, I don't even know that it ever launched, but I sold it for like $1,000 a year later. Then there's another thing called Color Mod, which was this like JavaScript color picker thing that I bought from someone else for $3,000. It was making money. And then like a year later, I sold it for $3,150. So, you know, I might have sold 10 of those during that year. I mean, I made probably $100 off of it over that course of that year. Then there's something called SiteThrive. We're about to get into the good stuff, I promise. So SiteThrive was an HTML, CSS sort of slicing service. Those were big back then, where somebody give you like a PSD, a Photoshop file, and then you would turn it into the HTML and CSS that they needed. And so I did, yeah, you pay $139 a page. And I think I had like one customer or something like that. So sold it for $800 somehow, though. I made more from selling it than I ever did from building HTML and CSS. My one foray into drop shipping was a thing called Superior Mint. So coin collecting, drop shipping. I sold one singular coin. And that was it. And I shut that thing down. Oh man, that's sad. Then there's imagery. So this was Photoshop tutorials. I don't know why I kept coming back to Photoshop tutorials. I guess it was 2007. So ended up shutting it down. Didn't make anything of it. Then there was Decomodo, which was a blog of like cool stuff. So like cool hunting was a big thing then. There's still blogs like this now where it's just like cool random things. Like, Uncrate is probably like the equivalent now, where it's just like cool stuff you found on the web. I sold that thing for $1,000 a year later. Also 2007. So this is when like late 2007 is when like I feel like I really start, or I stop doing the stupid stuff and like really start trying things. And so first, one of those things was called PugSpot. So my wife and I, we have three pugs. At the time, I think we only had, no, we probably had two. So we have three pugs, and you know, pug people are crazy. And we decided to start an online community for pug owners. So I used this thing to like teach myself Rails, like built this whole community from scratch, like built the forums. There was like photo uploading, video uploading, contests, like all sorts of stuff that I just built all these things from scratch to teach myself Rails. And it became for a while, like was one of those popular, probably top two or three pug communities on the internet. That's my claim to fame, right? So, we even like for a couple of years, we would put together like a calendar based on the photos that people were uploading. That was a lot of fun. Like there was this, you know, serious community of thousands of pug owners. Ended up selling that thing for $5,000 like 10 years later. It just like kind of fell to the wayside and I just didn't give it any more love. And so it kind of sort of pickled out. So then, 2008 is when I sold the Apple blog. So that is what this sort of brings us to now, or to this point in the timeline, where after PugSpot started, I ended up selling the Apple blog. And then I spent a couple of years mostly focused on working on the Apple blog. And so like the next thing that I launched was in 2010. So like from 2007 to 2010, it's basically PugSpot and like, I guess there's Fugitive Toys is in there too. And then the Apple blog was a big focus of mine. And I launched a product during that time in 2010 called Tech University. So with using like funds from GigaOm, like sort of heading this up, we decided to like build this sort of Mac video tutorial site. So, and it was going to be like a SaaS product. So like we produced dozens of like how-to videos, like how to do video editing with iMovie, how to edit photos with iPhoto, like, you know, all these different ways to like be a power user of Mail, like tons of these things, and really high quality sort of screen share kind of videos. I mean, really, really happy with that. And, you know, you'd pay a subscription to get access to those videos. And ultimately, like, we just couldn't, this is one of those, like, I'm building this within the context of GigaOm. And when a company like that, that's got dozens of different properties, if you can't get, unless it's just like really taking off, they're not going to give it the resources it needs. And it didn't get the resources it needs. And ultimately I had to shut it down. That was a bummer. Later 2010, I quit working on the Apple blog. Like I leave the Apple blog / GigaOm to not work there anymore and start this thing called Critterly, which is like a pet management app. So, you know, you kind of keep up with like when your dog needed to get its nails trimmed or when its shots were due or what medications it needed to take, or, you know, it could generate this like care guide thing if you were like leaving your dog with a friend. And so that was a SaaS product, never had any paying customers. I think I just lost interest with it. I mean, you know, I thought that it was a good idea, but it was like a solution looking for a problem. Couldn't find anything. So sold it for like $1,600 a year later. So PopSurvey is what's next. This is 2011. And this is like what sets the stage for ultimately where Baremetrics comes from. So PopSurvey, started off as a client project with, the two co-founders of Grasshopper, which was like a internet phone kind of company thing. So they pay me to build PopSurvey. And then by the time we launched, we decided like, hey, Josh should be CEO. I don't remember how all that came out, but like ultimately, like I'm running the thing. I've got ownership in the product and the company. And, you know, it's making a few $1,000 a month. And I decide that I need SaaS metrics. And that's sort of where Baremetrics comes from, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So PopSurvey, working on that, like that was my first sort of taste of like, hey, I can make thousands of dollars a month from customers paying me every month. And so worked on that for a while. And then in the middle of that started another thing with one of the co-founders of Grasshopper named David. The name of the service was called Deck Foundry. And it was like productize. It was like pitch deck designing as a service. So you'd pay us a few $1,000. We'd design a pitch deck for you to raise money. You know, it's like you're asking for money from people who need to go raise money because they don't have any money. There's just a mismatch of on the business side, right? So that didn't make sense. We shut it down. And then shortly after, a little spinoff of PopSurvey called Temper, which is like little smiley faces you can use to rate anything. So, you know, you could use it for like customer happiness, employee happiness, like just rating all this stuff and like graphing it over time. I thought that was a great idea. Either way. So then that leads to Baremetrics. So in 2013, PopSurvey and Temper, you know, making a few $1,000, I don't know, maybe $4,000 or $5,000 a month. And I wanted SaaS metrics at the time. Like there was nothing out there. Stripe was starting to take off, but there was still like, you know, you're just getting the analytics for that stuff was really difficult. You're either having to build these internal tools or, you know, pay a lot of money to use some external service. And neither of those were really a great option. So built Baremetrics as an internal tool and then ultimately turned into this, you know, like it took off, right? Like I had not planned on it taking off. And, you know, even once I decided like, hey, you know what, I'll turn this internal tool and like make it external so other people can use it. Even then, after it was like, okay, I'll get a few paying customers, and then maybe in a year, like something else will come along, and I'll get back to focusing on Pop Survey and Temper. Like that's where my head was at. And then it just took off. Like it kept taking off. And like within 6 months or something, it had surpassed any of the revenue from Pop Survey and Temper. And I was like, okay, like clearly I should not be focusing on Pop Survey and Temper. I should be working on Bear Metrics. And so ultimately sold off Pop Survey and Temper. I didn't make any money from that because, long story short, it was like money had been put in on the basically sort of like as an angel investment from my co-founders, and like all the money that we from selling those went to sort of for them to recoup some of their costs, right? So I made no money from the sale of that, and I just made money from basically the salary I gave myself when I worked on that stuff. So then Bear Metrics, so 2013 is when Bear Metrics launches, and it's just been, you know, going since then. And in 2016, so this is 3 years after I start Bear Metrics, I start getting this like itch to, I had missed working on different things because all the years prior to that, I was doing 3 or 4 things at the same time, right? And plus doing consulting stuff. So I had missed like the variety of like letting my brain work on different problems, and I needed some sort of creative outlet. And so I started this thing called Cedar and Sale, which is like sort of like handmade home decor stuff. So it's like these concrete planters. So like I'll design something on 3D printer and then make concrete molds out of those. And then there's just a whole line of this stuff, cedarandsale.com. Either way, I needed a way to like get my hands dirty and not stare at a computer and just make some stuff. The tangible stuff, and getting back to the e-commerce stuff. Like I missed doing some e-commerce stuff too. So I wanted to have a thing that I could sell online, and I didn't want to resell someone else's stuff. Like I wanted to sell stuff that I made that nobody else was producing. This is a Josh Pigford original, and have somebody buy it and it be this physical product. And so that's where Cedar and Sale came from. Been doing that since 2016. Then in 2017, I started making this thing called Rockberg, which is a music simulation game that I'd been like bouncing around in my head for probably 10 years prior. So started building that thing. That's just like a fun little project to work on. Then earlier this year, started DropTune, which is like new music notification service. And that's like a scratch my own itch thing. I don't know that I'll ever make any money off of it. I'm just having fun. It's a thing that I need, so I decided to build that. And then there's this thing called Forge and Fabricate, which is hopefully launching in a couple of months, where it's like me producing a maker show and publication. So like how to make stuff, basically. Like there's all these different things, how to make, you know, concrete planters, or how to make a certain type of furniture, or whatever it is, like producing a show around that. So that's, again, Rockberg, DropTune, Cedar and Sale, Forge and Fabricate. Like these are all things that I feel like give my brain a break to chew on what are ultimately like these big strategic, where do we point the ship kind of goals for Bear Metrics. And so having all those things, while it is juggling lots of different ideas, it also, like, I feel like it helps me be a better CEO of Bear Metrics because it helps me have better perspective and not get so bogged down with just like staring at the same problems all the time, and kind of gives me a break from that. So that is the 15-year history of 57 different projects and businesses. Holy moly. That took almost an hour to talk through that. So now let's jump into some questions. So I'm going to start rocking these questions here that people have posted to the Ask a Question section. I'm going to start at the top based on like number of votes that people have made, and then just work my way down. If you have questions, keep adding them, and I will answer questions as long as I can. So first up here. So Tom asks, where did you find buyers for your projects, especially one that had not launched yet? So I found them on a website called Flippa. So at the time it was like SitePoint Marketplace. And then eventually, I don't know, somewhere along the way, they spun it off into this thing called Flippa, which is kind of a terrible name. But either way, so you'd post a project on Flippa, and then somebody would say, hey, I like the stats on that. I'm about to crack open a can of LaCroix. So that's... Flippa was the main thing. The Apple blog was this exception to that, where they approached me about offer an acquisition there. The rest, Flippa, though. That's a good place to list a website. Okay, let's see here. So if you could clone yourself, what project would Josh 2 dive back 100% or start new? What project would you dive back? Like, what would I go back and do again? Or like, wish I'm gonna assume that you mean if I could go back to like a project that I abandoned. If that's not correct, I apologize. If that's the case, I would say probably Adrigate, the like ad management thing. I don't think it makes sense to do that now, but you know, back then I wish I had done that. That or the toy store. I wish I was like that. I wish the economics of that made sense to keep doing. So, Andrew asks, what's the biggest mistake you've made? What's okay? So I think it's the selling stuff too soon, or like not. I think a lot of it was like earlier on was the perseverance stuff, is like not giving things a chance to like really get some legs, which is clearly a problematic thing for me, because I've got, you know, 3, 4, almost 5 dozen different projects here. So I think early on it was like, okay, you've got to like really try to give something a shot before you just throw it out the window. And I don't think that was always the case. I mean, some of these were truly terrible ideas, but I think it was just, you know, that's a really difficult balance to know when to give up on something and to say like, just like, you know, cut your losses and move on. But for me, I was like, I think a couple of those, you know, maybe 2 or 3 of those, I think I cut and ran too early. Damir asks, what was different about Baremetrics that made it successful? So Baremetrics was an actual problem that people were looking for a solution for, and it did not exist at the time. So if you wanted, you know, we launched initially as Stripe Analytics, which is still what a lot of people know us for, but we do offer analytics for more than just Stripe. But at the time, there was nothing. Stripe was really starting to take off, and nothing existed. So the timing was really good on it. You know, certainly within a year, we had like copycat competitors popping up left and right. Most of those have gone by the wayside. But it's this hard problem to solve. Like, you know, because it means you're either doing all this stuff in a spreadsheet, which nobody enjoys, or you're having to build some internal thing. So that's what I think made it successful, was like, it was the right sort of, the size of the pain was significant enough. And our solution to it was such an easy thing. You click a button, like that's it. There's no setup. You just say connect with Stripe, boom, done. So it was a really easy sell at the time. Andrew asks, what makes you do this? I don't know. I guess I'm insane on some level. My brain is constantly, like, I'm the guy who has a really hard time going to sleep at night because my brain's just always thinking about things. I can't read, nonfiction before bed because like it gets the wheels turning on something too much. And so what makes me do it is like this drive to like, I get such a high from like seeing a thing become a reality that's in my head. So like thinking of a thing is fine, whatever. Like the idea is fun. Like that's a fun activity to like think of fun ideas, but being able to take the idea and then like make it a thing is just the most amazing thing for me. And I think that's why I keep showing up every day to do anything, because it's just such a good feeling to have an idea and then see it become this like some sort of reality. Like there's like a chemical reaction in my head that it's kind of an addiction. So, which product did you quit way too late and why? What did I stick with too long? That's a good question. I probably stuck with, probably Pop Survey for too long. And I don't know that, like, I think with the right person could like make it a solid thing. I mean, I think somebody still owns it today, and it runs it, but it was just, I think I did not pay attention to the signs early on that it, that there's just not enough of a demand for it. You know, like Typeform exists now, which is an amazing survey app and kind of like what we were hoping to turn Pop Survey into ultimately. And it just didn't, you know, they had better execution. So, I think I stuck around with that too long. I don't regret it because it ultimately is what led to Bare Metrics, right? So, but I do think from a product idea standpoint, I stuck with that too long. Fletcher asks, what is the reasoning behind stepping back from the sale of Track the Pack? So I kind of touched on this, but I had seller's regret or remorse when I sold it because it was like, I just started having these, after I had like finally put all the stuff together for the sale and saw all the things that were involved and how many customers we had or users and all the ideas that still hadn't been implemented that could be implemented, it felt like there's still something here. And so I, you know, sort of chickened out there and then decided to keep it around and then just didn't do anything with it. So bad move on my part. Let's see. So question is, how do you find and approach your potential buyout of products you want to sell? How do I find an approach? So this is the whole Flippa thing. Like they take care of everything. You just post all the information about the product, traffic, any kind of numbers, revenue, whatever, and then buyers ask questions. But it's just sort of a marketplace. So Shai asked, what were your first steps in most of these startups? Research, MVPs, just coded and built it overnight? Most of it was just coded it, or you know, basically did an MVP. Like, just built something really quickly, like Bare Metrics. It was about 7 or 8 days of work, spread out over a month. But I mean, like, that was, I was consulting at the time still, and I had Pop Survey and Temper, like, running those businesses. And so I just threw something together really quick. And that was the case for most of these, was like, let me just have an idea, let me put it together, see what happens. So that was the first step, was just to make something. And I think for a lot of people, they do, I probably don't do enough research, but I think most people end up doing too much and they try to answer all the questions that are unanswerable without some sort of functioning prototype. So for me, it's just, I get a lot more value out of just putting something out there and seeing what the response is than like researching theoretical responses. So Jonathan asks, how did you set up your shell company Sabotage? I mean, it's a LLC that files as a S corp. This is like boring tax stuff. You just talk to, a CPA about that, but that's what I've gone with and it's worked well for the past, whatever, 14 years or something. All right. Nick, asks, what's the line between I have an idea and I'm going to make a business out of this? I think I'm earlier on, I was much more motivated for like, how can I turn this into a business? And so it quickly turned into like, ooh, I have an idea. Ooh, I wonder if I can make some money. Ooh, let me try to make some money. Like that was the motivation. And now, it's much more, I have an idea. Let me just make it. And cause I want it. You know, like that's especially the thing of like a drop tune and like Rockberg, like, so the music notification and like the music simulation, like there's just like fun things that I want. I want those things to exist. And I don't know, they probably will never make a dime. I'll spend a lot of money working on them and host in Heroku billing. But whatever, like now it's more about, I have an idea and I want to see it a reality, and less like if I need to turn it into a business, okay, like I'll think my way through that, but that's less of like my motivation at this point, I think. Jorma asks, would you prefer to launch several projects in parallel or rather focus all your energy on a single project? I mean, clearly I launch lots of things in parallel, but I don't know that that's really a great idea. I think for most people, single project is you will get a lot more out of it. So my motivation for having multiple projects is different now. I don't think in 2013 when I launched Bare Metrics, having multiple things was not it was hard to spread myself across those. But, you know, and as soon as I figured out that Baremetrics was the thing that was taking off, I got rid of the other stuff. So I could only focus on Baremetrics for 3 years or something. Like, and so now my motivation for having other things is not because I want other businesses. It's because, like, my brain needs to work on other things so that I can be like a healthy all-in CEO of Baremetrics. So I think if you're trying to get something off the ground and you're wanting to for it to like be this thing that becomes as big as you want the thing to be, being all in on it is the way to go. Lucas asks, why don't you put efforts to make Baremetrics even bigger instead of starting new projects? So I think the mistake there is assuming that I personally can make Baremetrics bigger. And the failure there is assuming that like I'm the sole proprietor of growth, and I'm not. They have a whole team of people who are much better at that than I am. And my job is not to make Baremetrics. Well, one, okay, so first off, it's not my job to implement the growth per se. But two, that also makes the assumption that I want Baremetrics to get even bigger and bigger and bigger. And like, it should just grow until it cannot get any bigger. And it's the biggest thing possible. But like growth for growth's sake is not anything that I'm terribly interested in. I think we want to make Baremetrics a useful thing. And as long as it's useful, we'll keep doing it. And we will keep trying to make it as useful and valuable to our customers as possible. And sure, we'll work on growth. But like, I'm not the best person to execute growth. And me throwing more time at Baremetrics doesn't equate to more growth. Like, I have to, at this point, what equates to more growth for Baremetrics is me being smart about the things that we do. And me being smart means that it's a mental game. And if I can't approach things with like a clear point of view or a clear perspective, if I'm feeling burnt out, like I've been staring at this thing for ages, and like, you get some tunnel vision there. And so, I don't think effort directly equates to growth, nor do I necessarily even want it to keep equating to growth. Like, that's not the motivation. So, I think I put in the proper effort for Baremetrics for my role and, for what the company needs. I don't think that it's, too many people think that it, like, you just have to like keep just like smashing something with a hammer until it becomes the thing you want it to be. But you can't just like bludgeon something into, you know, existence. Like there's a point where being smart with what you're doing, outweighs just pure execution. So especially when you have a team, how many competitors or people plagiarize Baremetrics? So we've had dozens. Like, there was a time where at least weekly, people were sending us a link of companies, people who were building a random thing that looked like they clearly just tried to copy Baremetrics. Lots of that. And then also lots of people who like saw Baremetrics and like, especially after we started publicizing our metrics, started making their own Stripe analytics things. But, you know, most of those don't still exist, because that's actually hard to do it correctly. But I mean, over the course of the past 5 years, probably 30 plus people popped up trying to copy us. Maybe more. I don't know. Travis asks, how have you handled dealing with areas of your business that aren't or weren't your strongest skill areas? So I think part of being the type of like entrepreneur that I am is that I can generally teach myself to do the base level of anything. I won't necessarily be good at most things, but I can hack something, whether that means on the development side, on the design side, on the marketing side, customer support. Like, I can base level make something function to get it working. And I think that, that's a specific skill set of mine, is like the ability to just figure out lots of things. Certainly not become great at any of them. I think like how I, as far as like how to handle those, is to learn how to do the base level of what needs to get done in a given scenario. And then as quickly as possible, hire that out to someone who's much better. So that's how I handle it, is like have someone else do the thing, because I'm not the expert at all. Let's see. So we've already answered, where do you sell your, let's say, so where do you sell your sites? Lipo, we've talked about that before. Aaron asks, do you have an exit strategy for bear metrics? Negative. So, the way that I usually answer this is like, do I think I'll be like 70 or 80 years old and still working on bear metrics? No. But at the same time, I'm not building bear metrics for some big exit. For me, it's like, I'll keep working on bear metrics as long as like I'm still learning new things, and as long as I still feel like we're like that as a company, we're offering value to customers and not just doing the same thing every day. Like, for me, it's important that we keep sort of innovating, to use sort of a buzzword. But I don't have a specific like, okay, when bear metrics gets to X amount, we're going to sell, and when we get, and it's going to take us 3 more years to get to that, like, and then we'll be done. As that's not the motivation for that at all. Let's see. Dave asks, what kept you motivated even in phases where few projects really struggled or even failed? How do you keep motivated? The motivation for me is the getting to see something become a reality. So like, I didn't necessarily care that if something failed or not, because I already got the sort of adrenaline rush of seeing something become a reality. So the motivation for me, like where I would struggle or like even feel like I failed, is when I couldn't make something the reality that existed in my head. So if I could not make something happen, that frustrated me, and like I would be really depressing. Let's see. Ashkin says, what about focus? Like, when you go for a new project or idea, like, how do you focus on it? I guess that's the question. It's not hard for me to focus because, again, like, it's such a exciting thing for me to have an idea and to go for it. And so I can get really focused on that and go all in. I guess maybe the other side of that is, how do I make sure that I don't get distracted from, say, bear metrics or whatever? And that's just, a lot of that's about goal setting and saying like, okay, here are the things that I need to do to reach this goal for bear metrics. So that takes top priority. And then anything else just sort of fills in the gaps. Shay asks, why do you think your Amazon affiliate websites have failed? And what to avoid of going into that area? Man, I have no idea. That's been almost 15 years. Like, that entire landscape is entirely different than it was 15 years ago. And I did not do that well 15 years ago. So I'm afraid I have zero useful advice for you on the affiliate stuff. Which product do you think you learned the most from, and why? So I think, like, based on what I'm doing now, it's probably like that first sort of SaaS thing that I had, which was Track the Pack. So like, learning how the like subscription world worked, and, you know, just building software in general was super enlightening, from that project for sure. Let's see. We've already answered Jace's question here about listing websites. Pug is a dog. Yes. Ryan asks, have you bought any companies? Well, no. I guess I've bought, there's that thing Color Mod in 2006, which was like an existing little product, but no, I've not like acquired another company. Dan asks, how are the items in Cedar and Sail created and fabricated? I don't think I have any of the molds, but so when I 3D print a plastic shape, then I create a mold from that to pour silicone over. And then I have a silicone mold that I then pour concrete into, which ultimately you get concrete out of. And in this case, you know, I paint some of them and whatever. But yeah, it's basically like 3D print, make a silicone mold, pour concrete, done kind of thing. Aaron asks, are you interested in making a mobile app for bear metrics? Yes. We have it designed We just haven't had the resources or the time available to actually produce the app. But it's designed and ready to go, which, you know, isn't helpful. Do you use titles or roles in your startup? And what title do you have, CEO, et cetera? I don't know. We don't ever talk about it. I'm technically the CEO. But right now, everybody is mostly, like, they have a high-level role, like engineer or designer. But having titles, I don't know. We don't really ever talk about it. Sebastian asks, can you talk about upcoming features of Baremetrics? Not unreleased ones, but I can say we have a couple of big ones coming out in the next 6 weeks or so. Big, yeah. Substantial additions to Baremetrics. So all around, like, trying to expand sort of like a suite of tools around Baremetrics and not just like, how do we add more metrics, but how do we make those more useful to you? Will asks, how do you go about hiring out? I mean, for us, typical hiring process is writing up a job post and then posting it to all the different job boards and then just interviewing people until we find the right person. It's a very long, I understand why people hire HR people or recruiters, because it is an extremely time intensive thing to do. It's a full-time job if you're hiring. Like, for me, if I'm hiring, like, we were hiring a designer recently, I could only focus on hiring a designer and processing the 1,000+ applications that came in. You just have to jump in there and talk to people a lot. All right, we're getting close to the end here of questions. So if, like, I'm about to answer the last question, actually. So if you have any other questions, put them in now before I finish answering this question, and then we'll wrap it up. Okay. So Jorma asks, how much effort and time would you spend before deciding if a project has traction or not? It depends on what the project is and what I want, what my goal is. I think the problem here, like, in answering these types of questions, is there being this assumption that there's a clear, whether it's metrics or some sort of like obvious thing that you can reach and then decide if it has traction or not, or if it's something is worth sticking to or not. But like, so much of it comes down to, what are your goals, right? Like, why do you stick with anything? What's your motivation? What are you hoping to get out of it? And if what you hope to get out of it has nothing to do with money, then that completely changes what the goal is, right? And to your follow-up, like, with Baremetrics, you knew immediately. I knew that it had traction only because from a revenue standpoint, it surpassed what I had built it for, right? So, like, it didn't make sense to like, focus on anything else except that. But that was, like, my motivation at the time was to build a company, right? And so motivations are different for everybody at any given time in their life. You know, like, your motivations as, like, for me, as a dad with 3 kids and a house and whatever, like, the motivations that are just different than, say, when I was, you know, a 19-year-old kid in college, right? Like, the motivations there are just very different. And so how you answer that question about does this have traction or should I stick with something will differ depending on where you are in life. You guys add a bunch more questions. All right, let's keep it going. All companies write about how they get to 100,000 MRR or 10,000 MRR. I'm curious how to get the first 10 customers. So for us, it all came from word of mouth via Twitter, really. I mean, I was sort of live tweeting a lot of this stuff and really trying to just sort of like talk about how it was being built. And so I was just tweeting about it as I went. And so that got me my first 10 customers. But again, the answer to that will also depend on what kind of business you're building. Sebastian says, using you guys for our startup was a no-brainer just for the dunning. It paid for itself real quick. Was that the plan or a feature added later on? So the dunning, which is actually called Recover now, was that feature, that feature initially launched a couple of years after Baremetrics launched, and then we rebuilt it like a year and a half ago. So that was not the initial plan. Over time, it's become clear, like, we need to add other products on and like not just be a dashboard of metrics. And so like that motivates a lot of the things that we work on now. Aaron asks, have you nailed churn? Nobody has ever nailed churn unless it's 0%. Always room to improve. Let's see. Dan asked, do you create all the items for Cedar and Sale or do you outsource that? No, I create every bit of that because I started the Cedar and Sale stuff because I wanted to make the things. Like I'll only make stuff to the extent that I enjoy making it and that I can make it. If I have to outsource stuff, then it ends up sort of defeating the purpose. All right. Potentially last question. Ryan asks, do you foresee more bundling of SaaS products rather than many individual services popping up? Let's see. Do you see a market for more bundling outfits? Okay. I do think that, so we for a while have been seeing what would be like the great unbundling of SaaS. Voice cracked. I'm 14. For a long time, this big, everything's becoming unbundled, pulled apart. You have these like hyper-specific apps for things. And so, you know, I've got an account with 100 different services and that's untenable. So now I think instead we're seeing more things come back into, you know, think of something like a HubSpot or even like an Intercom or like you can do so many things all within a single platform. And that's a win for everybody because me having to switch to 100 different services is insane. And each of those individual sort of micro products can do that thing really well, but them doing that thing really well provides no ultimate benefit to me to have to switch between all those. Does that make sense? I think so. All right. And then this question, do you have any ideas or things you'd like to see created but don't have to make right now that you don't mind sharing? I don't have any ideas to give you, if that's what you're asking. I've currently all the ideas that I have, I've ended up making, at least recently, that I thought were good ideas. Okay, that's the same question, so I've already answered that one. All right. I think that's all. It's been an hour and a half now, people. We have spent, I wonder how much lost revenue for your companies is because you've just wasted on hanging out with me. I'm kidding. This is a very good use of your time. But in reality, I'm very grateful for all of you that showed up. This was a ton of fun. I mostly liked talking through most of these terrible ideas. I appreciate everybody who's followed along. It really does mean a lot. And like I said, this will be available on the Founder Chat podcast. So Founder Chat, plural. Founderchats.com. You can go see, actually, there's lots of interviews, dozens with other founders that I think are great. And you should check those out. This will be up next week. And if you have any questions, shoot me a note, josh@bearmetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. And I think that'll do it. I'm going to finish drinking my half gallon of coffee here out of our massive Bearmetrics mug. That's all I got. Thanks so much. And I'll see you folks around. All right, there we have it. Me interviewing me. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out bearmetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@bearmetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends, that goes a long way. Thanks again and see you next week.